But let me say this, I think if there's a bias that we need to have, it's in my view for less regulation rather than more regulation. Without global agreement, the only defense we have is speed. Till international standard is achieved, we cannot slow down on the development of AI. You'll see a very strong technical founder build a solution and then go look for the problem. And you always got to start with the problem. And the best person to understand the problem is your ultimate customer. There's a lot of money right now for AI startups. And yeah. VCs are voracious. Venture capitalists are voracious when it comes to early equity. Don't be afraid to give up some equity, but make sure that you're raising money in a responsible fashion.
Welcome to the Regulating AI Podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI Podcast, which is dedicated to promoting responsible AI practices through meaningful conversations with global leaders. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri. In today's episode, we are honored to be joined by Congressman Nick Begich of Alaska. Born and raised in Alaska, Congressman Begich earned his bachelor's in entrepreneurship from Baylor University and an MBA from Indiana University before working at Ford Motor Company in technology and product development roles. Since returning to Alaska in 2004, he's launched numerous businesses and served as a startup coach and mentor, helping early stage companies navigate the path to success. Congressman, welcome to the Regulating AI Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Congressman, you've had a tremendous experience as an entrepreneur and now as a legislator. It's obviously the big interest is always how do you balance innovation versus, you know, regulation. How do you see, because you've been on both sides, how do you see, especially when you look at AI, how do you see the balance between government regulation of AI and allowing market forces to shape the development of this transformative technology?
Well, it's a great question, and I think that it's one that there's no easy answer for. But let me say this, I think if there's a bias that we need to have, it's in my view for less regulation rather than more regulation. I think that when you look at the global competitive environment for artificial intelligence, you see that in order to have an effective set of regulations, you've actually got to have a globally harmonized set of rules of the road. We don't have that right now. And I think the United States Congress in particular has to be careful not to hamstring artificial intelligence development in a way that would push that work to other jurisdictions. And so I think it needs to be carefully constructed. It needs to be carefully thought out. There are needs to ensure that there are guardrails for the technology, but we do need to keep the environment open for competition and amenable to investment. And anytime that you add too many regulations too fast to a nascent industry, you run the risk of chasing that work to other jurisdictions or hampering the development and delaying the development of that work in ways that would not otherwise have naturally occurred.
So obviously, this is a truly transformative technology, I think, as you've said, and make sure we don't hamstring it. Are there some specific guardrails that you think would be helpful for something of this nature, Congressman?
Yeah, I think I can get to some of that in just a moment. Let me set the stage, though,
sure,
with the way that I perceive what's happening in AI. I think we have three simultaneously intersecting J curves in AI. You've got base AI, which is rapidly approaching a point on that J curve that we call AGI. Once we pass AGI, we hit artificial and super intelligence. And that is more of a segment of the curve that is beyond AGI. We don't really know how high it goes, where it plateaus, if it plateaus at all. So we've got that J curve. We also have the J curve of agentic AI. Mm-hmm. So that is the ability for AI to work on behalf of individuals and on behalf of companies or even perhaps governments. So an agentic AI that's empowered to some degree to act on another's behalf. Mm-hmm. Then we have, so it's more of a goal-based AI. Then we have physical robotics and the AI instantiation thereof. And these three intersecting J curves create real challenges for regulators mm-hmm. because A, most regulators don't come to the table with a specific set of experiences that would prepare them to understand how to regulate the technology. But B, the technology itself is moving so rapidly mm-hmm. in such, in many respects, unpredictable ways mm-hmm. that putting boundary conditions on the technology becomes challenging. However, now with that as the backdrop, getting back to your question, I do think there need to be some thoughtful regulations around the boundary conditions for agentic AI. Agentic mm-hmm. AI, when it starts to work on behalf of an individual, we have to start thinking about whether we should empower agentic AI to, for example, enter into a contract relationship that would perhaps bind someone financially. Mm-hmm. Should we allow agentic AI to engage in conversations as though it is the person itself or himself or herself, right? Do we really want AI to represent that AI is me or it's you? And so there are boundary conditions in the sense of agentic AI because we are outsourcing individual agency mm-hmm. to an AI entity on behalf of an individual. And that's where I think we need to be really cautious. We do need to make sure that there is some mechanism for personhood validation mm-hmm. when it comes to agentic AI. Is this agent truly authorized to work on behalf of the individual? And am I speaking to the individual's AI or am I speaking to the individual, him or herself? And so those are some opportunities for us to provide some rules of governance that make sense when you're talking about an agent and an AI-empowered agent specifically. And so, yes, I do think there are, and those some specific examples, instances where Congress does need to act. Ideally, they're doing so in a harmonized fashion with others around the world. But I do think that for the purposes of protecting the consumer and for protecting others online from impersonations, et cetera, there is a need for some governance framework.
Well, that's very helpful. And I hope our listeners, we have global listeners, understand why we wanted to have you in there because you've broken it down. I might be talking, I could close my eyes and be talking to a CEO of an AI company. You broke it down beautifully in those three things. So if I can just, follow up on some of these things. You talked about agentic AI. There is a act of agency that happens. As you said, it could be with a company, it could be with the government. Where is the responsibility, in your view, going to fall? Is it if some kind of an agency contract needs to happen for the actions? Is the responsibility, if something kind of goes wrong, is it the AI company that is making it, the person who's giving the agency, et cetera? Are you thinking about those kinds of guardrails, Congressman?
It's an interesting question to try to answer in the using the backdrop of speaking specifically about U.S. regulations, the backdrop of what was done to provide a certain level of immunity to platforms mm-hmm. At sort of the dawn of the World Wide Web in the United mm-hmm. States, legislation was passed that would essentially absolve platforms of the responsibility, the historic responsibility of content moderation. Mm-hmm. And so that content moderation responsibility, if someone were to say something on a platform that is not accurate, if it was defamatory, those things then the liability didn't fall to the platform operator in most cases. They fell to the individual making the statement or the company making the statement, and that's where the liability went. I think it's going to, this will likely follow a similar framework ultimately, where true platforms will likely, and this is my one person's opinion, but will likely enjoy similar or parallel types of immunity. Mm. But when the tech stack, when the application layer comes in over the top of AI and you have an agentic AI application, I think that that's where it gets a little thornier, because the agentic AI publishers will likely want to make the case that they themselves are platforms. But to the extent that those operators have the ability to manage the contract between an individual and their designated agent and the logic that sits in between those two individuals or entities, that's where the liability question becomes hard to answer. Because unlike the historical parallel that we're drawing with platforms, mm-hmm. AI is different because it's a black box logic model. So it's very difficult even for the developer or the user of the application that's leveraging an AI layer to mm-hmm. actually be able to deterministically say that the agent is operating in the best possible way for the user or the individual that's being represented. And so I think that will create some thorny legal questions down the road, because you can only test this this product so much. You can test certain edge cases, but I think it will probably fall to the application publisher, because the individual user will not be able to understand the logic construction of the agent well enough to be liable for what the agent ultimately does on their behalf.
Well, that's very true. Congressman, OpenAI just recently released this, so to speak, their PhD level researchers, so to speak. If I were to take some of the points that you raised, let's say these PhD researchers come back with some fantastic information, and as you said, there's a black box. Sometimes, maybe if that information is not accurate, but it is relied on because these are PhD level researchers, that could be, and you know, some of these could be in the area of chemistry, manufacturing, biology. There could be issues in terms of where is the accountability and those kinds of things, that I think that's some of the things that might be for us to look at as things are developing very, very fast.
Yeah, I agree. Those are things to look at. And I think, you know, when it comes to PhD level analysis, really these toolkits, you can sort of bifurcate AI into meta-analysis, mm-hmm. where they're looking at groups of previously performed studies in order to draw correlations that mm-hmm. that could result in a validated causation effect. Mm-hmm. So you've got that body of work. And then you have sort of imputed discovery work streams, where you have some level of intuition that's baked into the AI that says, mm-hmm. look, you know, based on what we've observed in this body of work, here are some potential areas of future discovery that have not been fully explored. Mm-hmm. But I think in both sets, it will require validation from a researcher in the real world to confirm, A, this meta-analysis has discovered something novel, let's go confirm it, or B, this is an area of discovery that we should further investigate, but will require additional real-world experimentation to validate. So I think in both cases, you can't really rely on that PhD-level analysis as the final say. It's all going to have to be validated by real-world researchers, but it should make the research effort in aggregate more efficient.
Absolutely, absolutely. Congressman, you're from the great, great state of Alaska, one of my favorite places. When you look at some of these tools that come in, I mean, one of your big mission is to how the technology makes, Alaskans succeed. How, in the context of, you know, these agents, these PhD level tools, et cetera, how do you balance the technological progress that it these tools allow us while also protecting jobs, let's say, in Alaska and economic stability?
It's a great question. It kind of borders on the metaphysical in some respects because, mm-hmm. you know, what you do not want to see is an AI advance so rapidly that the human society in mm-hmm. at large does not have the ability to adapt fast enough to the mm-hmm. to its disintermediation of work. Right. And this is a concern that a lot of folks have identified for many years, in fact, going back decades, mm-hmm. that if AI really were to hit the J curves that we're talking about, mm-hmm. it has the potential to radically transform society. And it gets, and I mentioned the metaphysical because it touches on a point that also is now being more commonly surfaced, and that is human obsolescence. What happens to humanity's purpose mm-hmm. if work, as we think of work, is been so disintermediated by both in the white collar space and the blue collar space that there's nothing for people to do? And yeah. I think this is a valid concern. And you know, I know that there are those out there who have been of the mind that they've said, look, through every technological advancement that's occurred in the past, there's been plenty of work on the other side of that for humans, right? So instead of employing armies of typists, now we have personal computers, and you know, there's less of a need for the secretarial function than there was previously. Mm-hmm. So we can go through, and anyone can go through the move from predominantly agrarian society to an urban society, the rise of the white collar workforce, all those things. There's always been something on the other side for humanity to do that's made us more profitable, more productive, mm-hmm. Gave us our time back. So all those were good things. But, something this powerful and this wide ranging, I think it does incredibly raise those questions. There are things that regulators need to be thinking about. There are things that AI companies, frankly, need to be thinking about. And in this particular instance, there's not a good sort of silver bullet solution to what that looks like, because we are at an event horizon yeah. of the technology. There's no putting the genie back in the bottle on AI, but yeah. we can't really see beyond it either. We don't quite know what comes post AI.
That is true. Can't put the genie back. Congressman, sticking with Alaska, Alaska is in many cases a rural state, if you really think about it. And like many other states in our country, obviously we talked about making sure, you know, we don't impact a lot of the population, but we also want to make sure there is no AI divide, making sure that all Alaskans and people even in rural areas, because the promise of AI is personalized healthcare, personalized education, where a kid in Alaska can have the same physician, access to a physician from Harvard as somebody in a large city can. So a kid in Alaska can have access to a GP of world-class access because of AI. How can we make sure the rural places like in Alaska, et cetera, there is no AI divide?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the base requirement for tapping into we'll call it the AI cloud, mm-hmm. the AI suite of services, is going to be connectivity. So that's table stakes for everyone worldwide, but particularly in my state, mm-hmm. we need to make sure that there is a sufficient level of connectivity to take advantage of the AI benefits that will roll out and are rolling out right now. Starlink has been transformational for our state. There are so many communities. In fact, 82% of Alaska's communities are not on a road system. And so without satellite internet, broadband satellite internet, there are many people in the state that would have been left behind already. And so I think that's been transformational. I think redundancy is important too, having redundant core networks so that you've got a fiber alternative in the larger communities where it makes economic sense to be able to do that. In addition to Starlink, gives you some failover because we've got to have that redundancy, particularly when you're talking about satellite networks that may be interfered with because of cloud cover or ice or other sorts of weather conditions. So that's table stakes. I think also you need to make sure that the broadband capacity is sufficient to serve the public in a way that allows everyone to participate in each significant piece of AI, of the AI application stack. And so in the example that you referred to, you're talking about an individual interfacing with an AI physician, right? Or an AI supported physician. And, you know, to the extent that that interface requires imaging and imagery, well, that requires a higher level of broadband capacity than if I'm talking to a ChatGPT-like interface. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that everyone has that level of access mm-hmm. is very important. And then it's also about integrating the technology stack into the classroom in a way that is complementary to the learning experience. And so that no matter where someone happens to be born, where they grow up, they have the ability, the optionality to participate in what is being developed. And I think that's really important too. When you talk about digital divide, mm-hmm. you know, we may start divided based on where we end up as the lottery of birth works, yeah. but the technology provides us an opportunity to come together if it's available to us.
So I think what you're saying, Congressman, is the connectivity and obviously the ability in education that's going to kind of bring these even up things in rural communities in Alaska and rest of the country. I think that's a great point. Congressman, at the start of the conversation, when I asked you about AI regulation, you said you'd want to make sure that we stay ahead of the pack, especially globally. We have a geopolitical, I don't know if the race is the word, the right with China in terms of, you know, from a technological standpoint, in terms of geopolitical nature of what we are trying to do. What are your thoughts? They had a, you know, there's a race for AI dominance right now, which has obviously got geopolitical implications. What are your thoughts in terms of how we should, United States should position ourselves while also keeping the standards that we are known for, given that they had this DeepSeek moment and other things? Your thoughts?
Well, there's so much to unpack there. So most of our conversation thus far today has focused on the consumer sort of component of artificial intelligence, how it's going to impact the workforce, how it's going to impact education. But there's an entire separate line of conversation around how does this impact intelligence, national defense capabilities. And I think that's where this becomes a much more, let's say, relevant conversation for nation states, where individual nations are now exploring the possibility of using AI for network intensive offensive operations, mm-hmm. where you're seeing companies getting attacked through novel DDoS methods, and you're seeing nation state actors looking for novel ways to attack infrastructure. And so that's where the AI race, as you described it, comes into play, because what tends to happen in most industries is that there are compounding effects up that J curve. And so the benefits tend to accrue to the early mover that is able to maintain acceleration along that curve. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important as a nation that we invest in AI, not just on the consumer side, but also as it relates to our national defense capabilities. One of the challenges with this particular vein of technology is that unlike nuclear technology, where we have globally been able to, I'll even use the word, suppress that knowledge mm-hmm. of how people can go about building that technology. This technology tends to be heavily open source. It's well understood how to build the models. There's no way to prevent folks from really having access to that information. And because of that, because that barrier cannot be constructed at this point, it is a race. It is a race on the AI front. And, that's why I think that there needs to be some global conversations around how far we allow AI capabilities to go. I think those are healthy discussions to have because it is technology that benefits from a compounding effect, and that compounding effect can lead us down to an end of a road that we don't really want to get to.
End of a road that we don't want to get to. And you're saying there needs to be some kind of a collaboration. And you talked earlier also, Congressman, about harmonization and things of that nature. The European Union has got its AI Act. Now, we obviously don't have anything comparable. What, in your view, should we have work on standards? You said we need to have some kind of a dialogue happening with other nations or other countries, maybe like-minded countries. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think that's important. I think it's also important to just realize that the reality of the moment is this. Without global agreement, the only defense we have is speed. And so it's until a sort of international standard is achieved, we cannot slow down on the development of AI. And from a national security, from a national defense perspective, I think that most folks recognize that continued investment in AI is necessary, whether the regulatory framework can catch up to that is another question.
Right. Congressman, you had mentioned early on that, generally members of Congress are, in many cases, not unlike you are a real exception, equipped to handle, or at least, because they are dealing with, on the same day, dealing with Hamas, Ukraine, border security, etc. They can't be. For our listeners who are, experts and others, just any suggestions in terms of, for something that is so critical and transformative, what would you suggest? This is your first term in there, and you've seen this. There is an AI caucus out there. There is, there's a task force also, and a lot of your members have been on the podcast, and I ask them always, is what can be done to maybe, I don't know how to put it, but raise that level of awareness on this topic with the members?
Yeah, I think it's conversations like these that help to raise awareness. I think it's continuing to hold hearings on the Hill, mm-hmm. and ideally hearings that cross multiple committees, because you don't want those hearings to be focused only in one committee. You need to make sure that people who may not sit on a particular committee in the House or Senate also have the opportunity to discuss how AI will or could impact their area of jurisdiction. And AI is broad ranging. So there are good reasons why AI will impact agriculture, will impact energy and mineral exploration, will impact education and labor. It will impact every, and is impacting every area of our society. So I think it's important for each committee to have hearings and opportunities to hear from mm-hmm. experts in those domains that are utilizing AI or are on the verge of utilizing AI as a mechanism for, industry disruption, for efficiency gains, for improvements in discovery, et cetera, because that exposure is what ultimately can lead to smarter regulatory environment that will intelligently keep the innovation space aperture wide open, mm-hmm. but also make sure that we have the appropriate guardrails for the technology as it's deployed.
So having hearings and having different kinds of discussions, I think, is what you're suggesting.
It's the only way, because, you know, I come to the table with 20 years of technology experience. So I'm coming into the conversation with knowledge. Yeah. But a lot of folks come with different experiences. You've got a lot of folks who come to the table who are prior lawyers, or they are state house or state senate members. Some come from the business community, as I do. Others, you know, they come from a medical background. There's a number of doctors in Congress. So that we all complement one another as sort of a portfolio of legislators. And it's also incumbent on people like me to have conversations with others in the Congress that may not have as much exposure to the technology or the underlying themes of the technology as people like I do.
I think that's a great point. Congressman, when we talked about the U.S. keeping its, you know, technological leadership in this very important transformative technology, energy is one of the key components of this, because as you probably, you know better than most, AI is an energy hungry, energy dependent. Energy innovation has been something that you have been focused on for some time. What are your thoughts? I mean, we have traditional methods. People are now dredging up nuclear. I never thought in my lifetime would bring nuclear back. And there's now talk about fusion. But talk to us as an to our viewers in terms of as an expert. What can we do?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are working at, I don't want to say cross purposes, but there's two countervailing winds, and we don't know which wind is going to ultimately prevail. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned DeepSeek earlier, right? Mm-hmm. DeepSeek purportedly, we don't know for a fact, but purportedly a more efficiently developed model. Mm-hmm. So we know that there, because of the high training costs of each AI model, mm-hmm. there is a huge economic incentive to make the modeling effort more efficient. And so I would believe that that's going to continue. We're going to continue to locate areas in the AI development space that will compress the energy requirements for each incremental model. So that's one giant win. Another wind is the voracious appetite for modeling, and particularly not just general modeling, but area specific modeling. So a lot of the things that have gotten attention relate to, you know, general intelligence, right? Where you're actually, what I call it is a supra intelligent model is what we have right now, where Grok 3, you know, the latest versions of ChatGPT Pro, these model iterations are smarter than any one person, but in each individual siloed area are not smarter than the SME for each individual area. So we have sort of a supra intelligence model achieved already. We haven't achieved, some would say we have, but we haven't yet achieved true AGI. But super intelligence, in my opinion, we step into that when the model, a singular model, is capable of producing stronger outputs than any subject matter expert in any field. Mm. So in any case, jumping back to the question, you know, I think that those two countervailing winds, one for incremental modeling and the other for efficiencies in modeling, we don't quite know what the true energy requirements for AI are going to be long term. But I do believe that what we've seen already with data centers, with crypto mining, and then you add AI on top of that, mm-hmm. There is going to continue to be a voracious push for incremental energy production. So now the question comes, where's the energy coming from, right? So you do see a change in the conversation where forms of energy that were viewed previously as being sort of off the table are now coming back into vogue. And the reason why nuclear specifically is coming back is because it's inarguably the most efficient energy production method that we have right now. You can create more energy from uranium by volume than you can create from oil and gas by far, right? And so, and certainly beyond wind and solar. Now, we also recognize that AI and data centers specifically, and certainly this applies to the crypto components of data centers, they require a stable baseload power. So it's very important when you spin up these systems that they have reliable power, not just that they have a certain magnitude of power. And battery technology has not fully caught up with solar and wind. Now, there's been advancements, but there's a lot more work to do in order to efficiently store for long periods of time the energy that comes off of those variable systems. And so I think that's why you're seeing nuclear come back into vogue. That's why you're seeing a big push for natural gas as well. And, you know, at the end of the day, you do not want the supply of energy to become the limiting factor for industry advancement in AI for the same reasons we've already discussed in the podcast today. And so I think people are trying to remove that potential constraint from the industry by building ahead of what could be future energy demand.
So it's going to be interesting, as you said, that two countervailing forces working. So I strongly believe that we're going to see more and more efficient models, these small language models, on-device models, and maybe innovations even in energy that'll come about, because I think our innovators are going to find ways around this. But energy is going to be a key determinator. Congressman, finally, you've served as a startup mentor also, and you sit on the Science and Technology Committee. We have a lot of startup CEOs and others also who listen in there. When you look into the future, you talked about these three pillars. You know, you talk about agentic AI, you talk about AGI, and then you talk about robotics. Is there one final piece of advice that you would give before we go into our lightning round for them?
Well, you know, I think when it comes to startups and founders, I think some of the same advice that I would have given founders 20 years ago would be the advice that I would give today. I mean, you've got to take a look at the long term, look at the enterprise value that you're building. Start with the customer in mind, right? Sometimes, so many times, you'll see a very strong technical founder build a solution and then go look for the problem. And you've always got to start with the problem. And the best person to understand the problem is your ultimate customer. And so what I've told people for years is, if you start with a customer and you build the thing they asked you to build because they told you they would pay for it, well, at least you got one customer and at least you got some revenue. And the worst thing in the world is to spend a significant amount of your life energy building a product that nobody wants. So start with the customer, figure out what they need, make sure they're willing to pay for it, and then go build it. And if you do that, what I've told people also for many years, where there's one, there's many. So if you have one customer that's got a problem, you're going to have lots of customers that have a similar problem, and that's where you can scale your operation. So I don't think the fundamentals of startup development change. I do think that the speed, of course, is extraordinary. The other piece of advice that I would give is, you know, there's a lot of money right now for AI startups, and yeah. VCs are voracious, venture capitalists are voracious when it comes to early equity. Don't be afraid to give up some equity, but make sure that you're raising money in a responsible fashion. You know, some venture capitalists have a model where they just want to write checks, the biggest check possible. They want you to staff up as rapidly as possible. But as a founder, it's also your responsibility to make sure you're deploying the capital responsibly, that you're putting your company on a pathway to profitability. It doesn't mean you're going to start there. There is the land grab effect. But also, if you're going after a land grab effect, make sure that you have some level of stickiness in your product that will allow customers to stay with you over time. Because if the switching costs between you and another company are low, trying to buy business at a loss is a fool's errand, because you won't be able to keep it when you try to turn the corner on profitability.
Fantastic. I don't know if our listeners ever thought they would be listening to startup recommendations from a member of Congress, but he's given amazing advice. Start with the customer. Where there's one, there'll be many. And when you take money, take it wisely. And if you're going for a land grab, go for it carefully. And I think that's just great advice. Congressman, finally, we have this lightning round of questions, just one word answers. Not trying to put you on the spot, but just fun for our listeners who have attention span of people is getting smaller, smaller, smaller. Yes. With TikTok, right, and everything else. So yeah. You ready?
I'm ready. I may have to be a politician this time.
Yeah, please. You can. You can be a politician.
Okay.
More important for AI development, speed or safety?
I think speed for most of the AI technology. I think safety for some of the technology we talked about with respect to intelligence and national defense.
Okay. Bigger threat, over-regulation or under-regulation of AI?
In the short run, over-regulation. In the long run, under-regulation.
Okay. Will AI create more jobs than it eliminates?
To be determined.
To be determined. Federal AI regulation or state-by-state approach?
Federally for the broad guardrails, state-by-state for the details.
Okay. Open source or closed source AI systems?
Open source, as it relates to consumer technology, would be my preference, but I don't think it should be regulated in that way. And closed source as it relates to national defense related issues.
Sounds good. Final one, Congressman. Biggest winner from AI advancement, big tech or small business?
I think actually small business wins here because it reduces the AI has the potential to reduce barriers to entry for small business in a dramatic way. And so it's never been easier to start a company than it is today. And AI makes it even easier. So you don't need, for most small businesses, you don't need what used to be $500,000 or maybe even $50,000. You can get started for very little money. And I think that's a good thing for small business formation.
Yeah. I agree with you. Well, that concludes our conversation with Congressman Nick Begich on the complex and vital topic of AI and its regulations. As our listeners can appreciate, effective AI regulation requires balancing innovation with responsibility. I really want to thank you, Congressman, for taking your time. Really, your insights, I think it's going to be great for this Congress to get your input with your entrepreneurship, your background, the way you laid out the three pillars, and finally how you advise our entrepreneurs. So to our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode. Please stay tuned. And until next time, I'm Sanjay Puri, encouraging you to stay engaged with these critical conversations as we collectively shape the future of AI. Congressman, this was fantastic. I could have gone on for a long, long period of time, but I know how busy you are. So thank you for being with us.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.